A We Society podcast is about everyone. But one component of that We community does not get sufficient attention. Our children, who are, after all, our future. Neglect abounds, especially those unlucky enough to be born into our poorest families. And they are very poor, often poorer than in the global south, and with very few resources. Little reported, and an emerging national emergency, is the growing number of children suffering deprivation of liberty orders, literally what it means. In England and Wales, vulnerable children are deprived of their liberty, subject to severe restrictions on their day-to-day freedoms, and placed in hospitals, youth custody, or a care home, and often for long periods of time. These orders are made not just for mental health reasons for children, they may be subject to abuse or neglect by their caregivers. The numbers are rising dramatically, tenfold in the last 10 years. Last year, 1,238. The implications are profound. Many are placed far from their homes in hotels or inappropriate properties not designed for care, such as temporary accommodation or hotels. What's the purpose of these orders? Care or incarceration? Here to talk about the implications and impact, and also the alternatives, is Lisa Harker, director of the Nuffield Family Justice Observatory, established in 2019 to improve the lives of children and family by putting data and evidence first. Lisa, welcome to the We Society.
Thank you for having me.
We Society, what did you make of that title when you first heard it?
Well, I think about the reciprocal obligations we have to each other in society. And of course, because of the subject we're going to talk about today, I think most about children who don't have the luxury of a family, who are taken into care, who are in the care of the state. And I think about our obligations to them as a community, as citizens. I hope one day we will live in a society where we all feel we need to do something for those children because they are, as I say, without the comfort of a close family. And yet at the moment, we see that those children as very different to our own. They're very far from view often. And in particular, the children we're going to talk about today are entirely hidden from view. And in my view, we've got to do something about that.
Just make this vivid. I mean, it's a bit abstract talking about 1,238 children. Who are they? How old are they? And why have they been deprived of their liberty?
So we often say they've got complex needs, but actually they've had really complicated lives. They've often had a lot of loss in their life, been subject to abuse and neglect, either within their family or their community. By the time they reach teenage years, often they're displaying their distress through their behaviour. And that behaviour can be very aggressive to other people, or it can be to themselves. They can be trying to kill themselves.
Self-harming. Yeah.
Self-harming, suicide attempts, and so on. Or they might be so vulnerable that they've been exploited by a criminal gang or a sexual exploitation ring.
It divides evenly between boys and girls?
Yeah, absolutely. 50% each on deprivation of liberty orders. Age-wise, they tend to be around 15, 16 years old, although 1 in 10 is under the age of 13. So you get some very young children in these circumstances. But they're known to services. They're often well known to our services and have popped up in various ways to the police, to children's services, to health, education. They'll be known in the community. But they've reached a point where things have spun out of control. And suddenly professionals are terrified of what's going to happen. And they will move to restrict the child's liberty for their own safety. Often it'll be an emergency situation. Friday afternoon, application to the court. What can we do with this child? They're going to kill themselves, or they are at risk of a gang or something like that. Basically, we don't really have an answer to this problem at the moment. We don't have provision in place. Ideally, you wouldn't need to have provision in place if you didn't get to these circumstances. But right now, we have a national shortage of provision for children in those circumstances.
But what should the provision be? I mean, I have this vision of, you know, a 15-year-old living in a hotel or a care home, youth custody, with hardly any care or intervention around them. I mean, it's a de facto kind of locking the door and throwing away the key. I mean, it's not...
It's incarceration, really, by another means.
If someone's trying to kill themselves or self-harm or suffering mental health difficulties, I mean, being incarcerated is not going to do the business.
Well, that's exactly the point. It solves one problem. You can guard a child to try and prevent them from killing themselves. But what doesn't happen is the care that's needed to get them back on track. And so we have a system that's very much weighted towards managing that risk, that immediate risk to the child by guarding them. And so some of these children are placed in Airbnbs, rented properties that the local authority might have, and we've heard of them on canal boats and in caravans with an agency worker, because that's the only staff the local authority can get hold of at short notice, guarding them. They're held in these positions for long periods of time, and over half of the 1,300 children on deprivation of liberty orders are still on that order 6 months later.
Gosh.
So this is not a short-term emergency measure. It's a sort of holding pen, an incarceration that doesn't then turn into the care that any parent would regard as essential for a child.
Ruth, my mouth goes dry as I hear you talk, but I mean, I looked into the origins of these. I mean, the legislation that brought them in, some obsessive rounds of children's acts, going back to 1989. I mean, the intent was decent. I mean, the intent was, in extraordinary and exceptional circumstances, it may be for the good of the child that we have to deprive them of their liberty, you know, whilst we try to curate them. I mean, that was their origin. But it seems to become perverted, as you describe it, into a kind of system of organized incarceration. It's a kind of standing condemnation of our society.
It is. I mean, it was never intended to be used in this way, as you say, an exceptional measure only in very, very unusual circumstances. The fact that when they started to be used, these orders, there was no record of them. There was no mechanism to record them because no one expected them to be used in any great number.
It was still under 100 10 years ago.
Absolutely.
I mean, explosions come in the last, particularly since COVID, actually, hasn't it?
Well, COVID has played a part, no doubt about that. The complexity of the needs of children in the community have increased. But there's been a perfect storm that's happened that's resulted in this situation. We've seen, thankfully, the number of young people held in custody fall through efforts to see young people as vulnerable rather than criminals. We've seen a reduction in the number of mental health beds for children in these circumstances because it's felt that being on a hospital ward for long periods of time isn't great for children, and that's a good thing too. We've seen the number of secure children's homes that are built to provide holistic care for children decline over time, a lack of investment. There's less than 10 across the country now.
What was the figure, say, 10 years ago?
It was much higher. I don't know the exact figure, but it was much higher. However, there was also less demand for these places than there has been. I think the combination of increased need, moving children out of hospital, fewer children in youth custody, has just closed down the number of options. One thing that local authorities...
For those that don't know, understand that kids are in custody, but I mean, in a police cell, in a prison, what form does custodial care of kids happen that's different from what we're describing in a deprivation of liberty order?
So children might be in a secure children's home under a youth custody arrangement. You might think, well, if we've got fewer children in secure children's homes under a youth custody arrangement or a secure educational facility, then there are more places for children in these circumstances. What our systems of care have been very bad at is planning for this and doing joined-up planning across all these areas. So local authorities haven't invested in secure children's homes for the welfare of children. The youth justice system block purchases places for children across the country for youth custody use only, and they can't be used for other things. So there's a lack of joined up of planning, of thinking about where children might end up. And as a result of that, the private sector has moved in. So most children's homes are run by private sector providers. And when it comes to a desperate situation where you're trying to place a child at short notice under deprivation of liberty order, the private sector is the only place that responds to that need and asks for a very high price.
It doesn't have to be bad. Some are charities and some are genuinely good, but unfortunately some are profit motive, private equity, all of that.
There's absolutely brilliant practice in the private sector. Yeah. It's not a comment on quality of practice per se. But what has happened is the private sector has now been able to set the price for these emergency provisions. And that's sucking huge sums of money out of the system. You're talking tens of thousands of pounds a week to place a child in a single placement on their own under a deprivation of liberty order. So local
authorities... But that's what it costs, doesn't it, Lisa? I mean, sometimes it's very difficult in teenage years. A poor resource family, and maybe the two parents are at odds with each other and barely want to talk to each other. I mean, you hardly get to the end of the week with the resources they've got. I mean, it's not easy.
No, this is not easy work. It requires investment, for sure, but... We're spending a lot of money on really poor care at the moment. We're holding children in solo placements, single placements on their own, being guarded in that self.
Guarded, use the word guarded.
Yeah, I mean, that's how it feels to the young people, that they are watched, monitored. They can't go out by themselves. The ratios of adults to child is often 3-4 to 1. So there's a lot of adults around looking out for them. When you talk to young people about their experiences, they describe being watched, but they also say, no one's asking me how I am. No one's there for me, alongside me, caring about how I am. It feels like being guarded. It doesn't feel like being cared for.
Where are we in the debate? You had a big conference on April the 1st. What were the takeaways? Are there measures? And to the extent there are measures, are they as good as they need to be and should be?
Well, we've certainly got to the point where this issue is now out in the open, or at least more out in the open than it was, and an acknowledgement that change is needed. You know, the Department for Education, along with Department of Health, have acknowledged that change is needed. When we convened our conference in April, it was to bring together professionals who are already trying to do things differently, who could, if you like, show us what good practice needs to look like in the future. There are some extraordinary examples of that across the country, which are very inspiring. They involve leaders in children's social care and children's mental health in particular, acknowledging that they have shared responsibility for children in these circumstances and that they need to work very closely together to support them. Too often what happens in reality is that there's a sort of tussle between services as to whose responsibility these children are. There's often a lot of professionals involved when a child has a deprivation of liberty order. I mean, we've heard examples where there are 35 professionals involved in a child's case. But that involves lots of people in meetings talking about the child, and often a kind of reluctance to step forward and stand alongside the child, get to know them, stick with them for the long period. So in examples where it's working well, you see these leaders saying, no, we're going to work together. We're going to find a way to provide good quality care for these children that doesn't involve them having to navigate services.
So can you name a name? Can you give us an example of a part of the country where it's going well?
Well, I've been very inspired by what I've seen in Somerset, for example, where it started exactly like that. The two leaders, Children's Mental Health and Director of Children's Services, literally sat across a table and said, we've got to stop fighting over these children. We've got to do something about this. And what they've decided to do is to bring together their teams, so social workers and children mental health professionals working together to build their own facilities in Somerset for those children that are intended to be holistic in the support that they get. So quite often children...
Holistic is a word it means different things in different contexts. What does it mean in this context?
Well, so I describe children on deprivation of liberty orders as being guarded and being isolated and being watched. And really that's what their lived experience often is. They're not at school. They often say, no one understands my mental health needs. I haven't had a diagnosis. I'm not getting any treatment. They're isolated and lonely. They don't have connections in the community. So holistic support is the opposite of that. It is having people around you, you care about, connections that you maintain. You're not moved far away from home, so you don't keep in touch with the people you care about. It's about having some education. It's about being able to do normal things that young people do. I mean, a normal life. That's what one of the young people we spoke to said. I just want a normal life. I just want to do things that teenagers do. So holistic means that. It means a normal life. Our services have somehow lost a sight of the very basic things that young people need in these circumstances. Love, connection, normal life.
It's often a kind of very, it's sometimes a bit joyless. I mean, I was very struck by the founder of the Ezra Collective, who won the Brit Awards, a wonderful band, actually. And he's kind of saying, look, youth clubs were my savior. Mm. I was able to learn a drum. I could just, my heart's content. And they've been closed down. I can imagine a room with, you know, 25 earnest professionals discussing this. And actually, such a thought would seem to be kind of, that's not the kind of thought you should have or express.
I totally agree, though. I mean, one case really sticks in my mind of a child on a deprivation liberty order, 11-year-old child, I think, who was, you know, moved at short notice, miles away from home to a new place and under these restrictions. The judge, in writing the judgment, noted that what the child was saying to her was, I want my hamster. I don't know where my hamster is. And it was such a sort of arresting moment, because you think, actually, that's what kids care about.
Oh, yeah. Hamsters. Keeping them alive is tricky enough.
And, you know, and if you don't have much in your life and you're looking for love, actually, that really, really matters. And so how do we get back to systems that can see that and can hear what children tell us very, very, very quickly? If you ask them, what do you want? They can tell you in no uncertain terms. So Somerset is doing a great job. They're planning these long-term support for young people in these circumstances. But what's interesting is they're swimming against the tide. They've had to take risks to do that. And you think, well, why do you have to take risks? Well, often, you know, the way our inspectorates work is to try and eliminate the risk to a child, to be very, very cautious about, you know, the protections that need to be in place to keep a child safe. So if a child's trying to repeatedly kill themselves, well, you can imagine that Ofsted will come in and expect the home to be very safe, the restrictions to be very clear. And of course, sometimes you just, you know, you do have to take a risk to enable a child to have a normal life. And you can only take that risk if you know that your professional life is not on the line. What I've seen in Somerset is the leaders there saying, we share this responsibility. If something goes wrong, I'm not going to blame you and you're not going to blame me. We're there together. The question that we're asking is, how do we change the system so that this becomes not exceptional, doesn't rely on exceptional leadership, but it can be the status quo?
And the risk is that you do something imaginative, like, you know, allowing the kids to have practice drumming or go and buy a hamster and go to the pet shop and all that. And actually something untoward happens and there's a kind of national hue and cry. And actually a politician craving short-term popularity will say, you know, this director of care should be sacked or whatever, or go through painful court processes. That's what you're talking about?
Yeah, it is. It is. And I think we have to acknowledge that we are a society that does that, that very quickly looks to say, how do we stop this ever happening again? Who's to blame? And of course, you know, we have to learn lessons. But if our primary focus is on risk to the exclusion of these other things, I think we have end up with a system which incarcerates children. We've ended up here because of that.
This season of The We Society is brought to you in association with the Nuffield Foundation. For more than 80 years, the Nuffield Foundation has funded research and innovations that sit at the heart of some of society's biggest challenges. Evidence has the power to change lives, whether it's improving educational outcomes, reducing inequality, or understanding how society is changing. The Nuffield Foundation's work helps policymakers and practitioners tackle complex problems. To find out more about the Foundation and its research centres, visit nuffieldfoundation.org. Before we discuss what else you do at the Family Justice Observatory, just in this territory alone, if I gave you divine qualities and you had an hour to kind of exercise your divinity by coming up with this bunch of measures, what would they be?
I think I'd start at the top. So I think we have to have national leadership on this issue, where we have secretaries of state owning the problem and recognising that it is a shared problem.
Wes Streeting and Bridget Phillipson wouldn't be blind to any of this if they were sitting in the secretaries of state for health education, respectively.
We've got a long way to go before it feels that that's a joined up system. And it absolutely fits with the missions for this government. And there's no doubt that people would be warm to the idea, but we've yet to see it in practice. So it starts with leadership, I think. And I think it starts with,
leadership, I give you that. But I mean, what sits behind leadership is kind of an idea of what to do and a sense of purpose. He really got me going reading the background papers on this. And I was thinking that actually to do something about this, there has to be a prior sense of real purpose. What is we as a government about? What are we at local leadership about? Where as a country are we trying to go, you know? And absent that, you end up with kind of a blame game and incarceration of these kids.
Yeah. And it goes back to what we said right at the beginning, you know, what is a we society? And what do we want for the children in our care, the care of the state? We think of them perhaps as a different group of children to the rest of society, but they are our children. So really thinking about what that means, not just in terms of what professionals do, but actually what communities do. You know, for a lot of these young people, you know, the person they most want to help from is the football club or the youth club. You know, it's a shared responsibility.
Social science? I mean, social science, when you're a social scientist, we talk about evidence and data. How does that help?
Well, in this case, it has been absolutely instrumental in changing the conversation. So prior to 2022, there was no regular official data about deprivation of liberty orders. And at that point, the assumption was that this was only happening in some corners of England and Wales. As a result of the president of the family division, the most senior family judge in the country, inviting the Nuffield Family Justice Observatory in to study all the applications that were coming in on deprivation of liberty orders, we were able to provide monthly statistics for the first time. And that involved going into the Royal Courts of Justice, often looking at paper copies of applications and filling in spreadsheets. It's very basic social science. Hey. But it was agile. We communicated it very regularly and very clearly, monthly data that really forced people to sit up and acknowledge that there was a problem and showed that this was happening across all of England and Wales. There were 94% of local authorities in England applied for a deprivation of liberty order in a 12-month period. We could have a look at who were the children, what was their age, what were their ages, what had been happening to them. So social science made a difference. But I think it does also, for me, you know, I've worked in the space between academic research, policy and practice all my career. And I think what the observatory tries to embody is to make the best of all of those and to connect them up.
And what about the Family Justice Observatory in the round? I mean, we've talked about deprivation of liberty orders, but I'm guessing there's more to what you do than that.
Yeah, so we're interested in the lives of children about whom decisions are made in the family court. So that includes all child protection cases, but also children in separating families where there's a dispute about the arrangements for children. So actually 2/3 of family court cases involve those kind of cases. So we are trying to be a catalyst for change for those children by using data and research to shine a light on practice, but also use our observatory status, our independence, really, to convene conversations across systems and get people to come together to look at issues afresh. So we've been looking at why there are so many babies being taken into care and what you can do about it. We've been looking at...
Why are so many babies taken?
Well, good question. Because of the lack of preventative services. It's a adult mental health problem. It's a drug and alcohol addiction problem. And it's a failure to provide sufficient family support. But it's an absolute scandal that when a mum and dad have a baby taken into care you know, one in five of them will return to court with another baby being taken into care. There's a cycle of removal of babies because of our failure to sort of pick those families up and provide them with the support they need.
In moral philosophy, there's a concept of kind of brute good luck and brute bad luck. And the use of the word brute is well chosen because this is not just good and bad luck. It's luck that you've done nothing to deserve. And I'm thinking of a kind of a tiny baby that's been taken away from it, mother and father. Nothing to deserve kind of being born into this circumstance and nothing to deserve what's going to subsequently happen to them. And actually, you know, a good society, everyone, and the best parts of the biblical spectrum, at least from kind of Winston Churchill through to Clem Attlee, you know, would say you judge a society to the extent it kind of leans against brute bad luck. You would say that's not happening.
No, it's not happening. It doesn't take much to make it happen, which is also, you know, part of the story, that we know what you can do about it. And there are some amazing services. I was talking to one yesterday in Swansea, who have had an incredible effect at reducing the number of babies coming into care. Again, you know, it's the same message really, because what they're doing is getting alongside the family and figuring out the difficulties that they have, whether there are housing difficulties, whether there are issues relating to poverty, whether there are problems around addiction, whether there's domestic abuse. And then they're getting to the parenting part of it, but they're often having to help the family get back on track, essentially. The gravitational pull is to remove the baby, to reduce the risk, you know, that there might, something terrible might happen, so we've got to move quickly.
How has it happened that Lisa Harker has actually got involved in all of this?
I've spent my 35-year career working on issues relating to families, but it wasn't until I adopted two children 16 years ago now. My eyes were open to how the family justice system worked. I've learned so much as a parent as to the impact of trauma on children and how they develop and what that means for them. So I have increasingly been interested in these children, the children who, through no fault of their own,
Brute bad luck,
find themselves in the worst of circumstances in their childhood. And, you know, the question in my head is, how do we help them lead a happy, purposeful life?
Lisa, thank you for that. You're inspiring and also very concerning. You know, we've covered a lot of ground there. This tale of incarceration of a growing number of our teenagers with adults, in a sense, policing them rather than trying to do something about why they're being incarcerated, is a kind of salutary statement, and we should all take it to heart. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences in association with the Nuffield Foundation and Leverhulme Trust. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. And thank you so much for listening.